Well then, I apologize. What kind of monster shows up late to a podcast about Jurassic Park 3?
A dinosaur monster?
Dinosaurs aren't monsters, Joe. They're animals.
Not these ones. These ones are genetically modified monsters that are not
That's
real
That's up for debate.
Dinosaurs.
That's up for long, hour-long, hours-long debate that I'm looking forward to doing tonight.
Well, Dr. Grant was standing on the stage, and the people in the audience were just sitting down there in chairs like jerks.
Yeah, at Occidental University in Los Angeles.
Should I turn on the live thing before we get into this? Do we have any other technical issues we need to go over?
Or weird, obscure trivia about the shooting locations for JP3 that no one
Save
else will find interesting?
The weird trivia for the show. That's the whole show. That's why the show exists.
Yes, sir.
All right, I'm going to turn on the live thing and hope nothing explodes. It says it's on. Joe, commence with whatever GIF you feel like tweeting or whatever you're doing.
Oh, so Seth, boy. It is good to have you back on the thing with us.
It's so good to be on the thing with both of you.
World-renowned Jurassic Park aficionado, Seth Worley.
World-renowned Jurassic Park weirdo, Seth Worley. Yes. I'm just going to repeat everything you say, but in a self-deprecating way.
Oh, I thought that was a little more self-aggrandizing, making yourself a little bit more fanciful.
Yeah, like the primary source, so it's a big deal.
Mm. I feel like before we get into Jurassic Park 3, we should offer you an opportunity to say anything that you may have saved up about Jurassic Park 1 or 2, since you were unable to join us for those shows.
Oh, God, that's hours of stuff. No, I was so sad. I was traveling, and I couldn't make those because, one, they're both superior to this one. And, two, dinosaurs. I don't have anything to say.
The only thing I would ask specifically is, at the end of our Lost World episode, after we spent an hour and a half, 45 minutes crapping all over it, I said, people of the internet, tell me what it is about this movie that I'm missing that is valuable, because I can't seem to find it. I just find fault with pretty much everything. Everyone had a bad day when they made that movie. And so far, nobody has taken me up on the offer. Maybe when the actual official episode gets posted, not just the bootleg, people will at me on Twitter and tell me that I'm short-sighted and I'm missing the point. But do you have what are your primary happy thoughts about Jurassic Park 2, Lost World?
Happy thoughts about you mean the Lost World Jurassic Park?
Yeah, I did it backwards because they did it backwards.
They did it backwards, which I thought was so cool in seventh grade or whatever, how old I was when it came out. So I'm going to talk about what's good about it completely unrelated. Do you want me to talk about it completely unrelated to the first one? Or am I putting in the context of it being a Jurassic Park movie?
Well, I mean, I think the reason everyone went and saw it and the reason it made money and they kept making these is just because that if you're going to make something in the Jurassic Park universe, everyone's going to be excited, especially if it's the first thing to come out after the original. So everyone's excited to see it because of what it is. But as a standalone film, I find that it gives me a headache and I don't enjoy watching it.
It has a lot of promise, like on the front end. Like it doesn't have a lot of promise. It has a lot of that's not true. What I mean is, well, it's disappointing
it
how
has a
it
lot
ends
of
up.
Things
like
in it and it sets, people doing stuff.
Yeah. It does. It has a lot of loose ends. It sets things up that don't get paid off in any way. And if they do, it's weird and doesn't feel satisfying, it sets up, my God, it sets things up that are in the book that get paid off in the book. Like Richard Schiff's character, Eddie Carr, talks about the tranquilizer darts, or not the tranquilizer, but like the darts that'll kill you before you even realize you shot yourself in the foot. Nobody ever shoots themselves in the foot. Nobody shoots a dinosaur with one of those things.
Nothing happens
those darts at all. Yeah. And the thing, though, that I love about Lost World that I wish that is this thing. It's a thing that I love about Jurassic Park, though. It's just that it doesn't Well, I'm going to save that because that's kind of a thing about Jurassic Park 3. I will just say, like, things I love about Lost World are even things that people can poke holes in. Like, for example, I love the glass sequence with Julianne Moore, like the little glass gag with the on the trailer. And Stu Mashowitz makes a concerted effort to rip me apart on that anytime that I mention that I like that scene. And he's right. He's like, oh, cool. So when you watched it, you didn't know how glass worked yet. And
yeah, I mean,
Joe was curious why all of the cracks were coming out of her fingertips.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. They are. But man, I don't know. I like that trailer sequence. I like, hang on. I'm trying to remember because I didn't just rewatch this one. I watched three.
Do you like San Diego?
I like the beginning. I did the first time I watched it. That's one of those, San Diego's one of those things. Aaron Sorkin has a term that he uses, I think, or he's, Aaron Sorkin always just quotes William Goldman, so William Goldman probably said it. But when you can burn your furniture, like, and it'll keep you warm at night, but then you won't have anywhere to sit the next morning. And the San Diego sequence felt like that to me. It was like you, the minute you start a franchise with dinosaurs, you immediately are like, when those things get into the mainland, like, when are they coming to my house and when are they going to be running through the city? And it's like he just did it in this last scene, and it's like he's gone on record as saying, like, he knew he probably wasn't going to make any more of these, so he's like, screw it, I'm just going to do it here
for sure. And I was going to say that the rule of thumb would be that it's going to happen in the last movie that Spielberg directs in the series.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I'm not crazy about it. I love, the thing is, The Lost World is one of those movies that, like, the first time you see it in the theater, it's, and if you see it in the theater full of people, it's a lot of fun, but it does not hold up at all. Not even leaving the theater, it starts breaking down for you. But, and I'm saying that as the person who saw it for the first time when he was in, like, seventh grade, I think, which is still a period of time when I thought every movie was a gift to humanity. And I was still kind of in that place when Jurassic Park 3 came out, as we'll get to. But, you know, I don't know. I also, Goldblum, you want me to tell you what's good and redeemable about The Lost World Jurassic Park, I give you Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, I think we sort of came to the conclusion that he is the closest person in the movie to somebody who is acting like a real human being, even though he's still not exactly acting the way he would have in the or he did in the first movie.
He's thinking a lot in the second movie. He's walking around thinking about all the things that are probably happening and going wrong, like, not even when the dinosaurs show up, he's barely even looking at them. He's looking, like, into this middle space, obviously because they're not there, but this middle space where he's imagining, like, oh my God, the horrible things that are going to happen. He's like, you see behind the scenes footage of Goldblum, and he's still doing it. It's because he's, like, getting in the headspace. And Malcolm looks like he's getting in the headspace for dinosaurs, like, throughout the movie. The thing is, that's Goldblum, and so you accept it and kind of love it. But if anybody else were doing it throughout the movie, it would feel weird.
Mm. I think that one of the things I struggled with is that anytime that there was a real character moment or a well done piece by whatever portion, the cinematography, directing, music cue, whatever, it was bookended on either side with completely unrealistic and nonsensical dialogue, characters, just unmotivated nonsense. So it's very difficult to give them the benefit of the doubt, whereas in Jurassic Park 1, you can forgive any logic holes, technical flubs, whatever, because everything around it is so perfect. So it's kind of like an inside-out version of the Jurassic Park that we came to know and love, and it's just like, it's hard to forgive these really odd things that are occurring that don't really make sense or satisfy you in any way.
Which is why they fixed it for the third one.
Oh, man. That's can Inside Out version of Jurassic Park is such a good description. That's amazing. I left out the thing that I would say is redeemable about The Lost World is that the Lost World contains my favorite death of all the Jurassic Parks, which is Peter Stormare's death by compies.
Oh, come on, really?
I love that freaking scene much, and I will break it down for you.
It's the blood through the river.
No. It's the blood of the river, man. Well, it's the fact that, okay, it's a classic Spielberg, like, death scene in that, it has the whole process of, like, I think something weird might be going on. Here is evidence something weird is going on. But maybe it'll go away. Oh, wait, no, it's back. And ouch, it's actually hurting me. Here is one shot of blood to make you feel really uncomfortable. And that's where it's, like, ripping at his lip. And then get the things off of him. Maybe I'll be okay. But nope, this is it. I'm dead. I'm going to go over this log. And now they're going over the log and blood's coming around the river. First off, in all the font, like every Jurassic Park movie going forward after The Lost World, anytime you like cut to blood somewhere, like you had someone die, like sucked out of frame and you cut to blood somewhere, it just cuts to a shot of a wall and blood splatters, which is the laziest freaking thing you can do with blood. Spielberg knows how to bleed people out on screen. Like it's
what
I'm giving you so many titles right now for an episode and it's not even the right movie yet. I love the motivated movement down to the river with the blood coming around. And I also have I'm biased because my favorite kind of like movie monster or creature is lots of little creatures.
You like the death by a thousand cuts?
I love it. That's my absolute favorite. So yeah,
but you again, know. I know you weren't there, and I hate to keep reiterating things for people who are probably just heard us talk about that. The thing that ruins that is right before that, he just the whole miscommunication with homeboy who's jamming out to his Walkman or whatever for some reason. He's not terrified or worried or stressed. He's having a good old time listening to his radio, and he doesn't hear Peter Stormare say, "I'm going to go take a pee."
That's not the real problem.
30 yards
away.
The real problem,
30 yards away. Well, he falls down a really long hill, guys. A really, really long hill. No, the problem with that is that is Carter just sitting, I think that's his name, is he just sitting a mile away from the rest of the team? Like, why is he the only one that is able to hear the sounds that Dieter Stark makes? Like, yes, I know the character's name. Like, why is he the only... Because I had his action figure. Why is he the only one? Because I have his action figure. I think he's right here on my desk. Why is he the only one able to hear him? Like, if they all sat down, you know, and he's like...
Why when Peter Stormare is screaming isn't, like, you know, J. Random Dude
Roland
sitting
Timbo
next to
hearing
guy
him. Yes,
like,
I know
hey,
that
man,
character's name, too.
Over there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
they do a lot of that in this film. Like when they first are looking for Sarah Harding and they're like shouting Sarah, and then they like pan over a log and she's standing right there. And
she's right
like,
there.
Oh, hey, guys.
Yeah. And she's like, sorry, I was just looking at some Stegos. Did not know you were here. Like on my Stego. Sorry.
Okay.
I was going to say that we had mentioned previously that kind of undermines the compies for me is I wish we had not seen them in action prior to this, because when you see the danger that they pose to the little girl in the opening scene, then you kind of know exactly where this is going to go with Dieter. Whereas
you're right.
If you didn't know anything about these tiny little lizard things, you might be like, oh, they're just sort of pests or nuisances or something. You know that they attack people, so...
You're right. It's like the Dilophosaurus in the first one, like, which you don't see until you see it. And it's talked about, and it's hinted about, but you don't see it until you see it. You don't even know that's exactly what it is until its frills come out and it starts spitting. Yeah, you're right. I agree. Well,
now that we made you not like that movie...
Hang on, I had one last question. I don't want to make this about the Lost World because we already did that. But I'm curious what you, Seth, think about what Spielberg did in this movie, because I find, and I know he said he took some time off and he was trying to recuperate from the original Jurassic and Schindler's List and things, and he was trying to get back on his feet after some time away. But I feel like he doesn't feel very Spielberg in this movie. He feels very
He's
rough and is not
gone
doing
on record
a good
as
job.
Saying that the second he started working on it, he was over it and was bored. Like, he's gone on record as saying he was bored. It's like, it's pretty well known that David Capp directed a large portion of the movie. Like, there were entire scenes where he called it second unit, but it was really just him letting David Capp take the reins and direct. And I heard a rumor. It's unsubstantiated because I just heard it from a Universal exec years ago who I don't know at all. And
just chatting it up with those Universal execs.
I heard it from a Universal Studios executive in Orlando.
We had been drinking. We had like four bottles of water sitting on these
exactly
couches.
Exactly the truth. We had to pee like crazy. And the guy told me, first off, he pointed out that like the parking garage I had parked in was the parking garage that they hung trailers off of for The Lost World, which I thought was the coolest thing I'd ever heard. And then he said, yeah, you know, I heard that Spielberg directed that from his office, directed that whole scene from his office, like remotely. And when you think about it, it makes sense because his office is like a walk away or a golf cart ride away from that parking garage. And if you really want to just hang out in his office and direct it remotely from screens, like, I mean, not, I'm not saying it's the right thing to do. I'm just saying it's believable that he did it. But yeah.
You think he did it with screens? He didn't just call it up via phone and say, like, start with a wide and then push on or something?
Oh, man. Yeah, you're right. I'm giving it too big a benefit of doubt that he was actually seeing what was being shot. But, like, I think it's understandable that, like, you'd be Steven Spielberg and you go and you'd make Jurassic Park and you would, I keep saying gone on record, but it's just me saying I didn't make this up or get it from like Wikipedia, like, or I guess that is where I got it from. But like, on the first one, you know, he shot the first one and then he went off to direct Schindler's List, and George Lucas was mainly overseeing post on Jurassic, and Spielberg was, you know, speaking into it and approving, you know, dailies and stuff at the end of the day. But you're in the middle of shooting Schindler's List and you're going back to your hotel room and giving notes on a dinosaur movie. Like, I mean, I know the guy is very good at multitasking, but that is, I mean, it's hard enough to like, to be directing a burger commercial and come back and give notes on, you know, a iPhone app commercial. Like, just, yeah. The point is, like, well, I'm also not Steven Spielberg, but like, he went on record as saying that he did not like he didn't like Jurassic Park until he saw it in a theater with people. And he was like, oh, you know, this is kind of good. And like, I get that as a creative professional. And I get the idea of then going and doing Schindler's List and knocking it out of the park and winning Oscars and getting back, like, and then taking a long break and being like, I'm going to get my feet wet, but I'm not going to dive right into Schindler's List 2. Like, I'm going to do like an easy thing. And what people want is another Jurassic Park. So I'll do that. And you show up to set and you're like, nope, nothing here is challenging. Nope. I should have done Schindler's List 2. And then we have what we have.
I don't know. It seems like at that point you would kind of be assuming that it's a walk in the park to produce something watchable. And I think so much of my issue with it is it just feels like somebody doing a bad Spielberg impression or somebody just giving up. I guess rather than speculate, it would be good to know who, you know, how much he actually directed versus having somebody else second unit shoot it.
But I wish
it feels like somebody going like, what would Steven Spielberg do? And then doing a really piss poor version of that.
Yeah. I wish we could hire Steven Spielberg to sit with us and basically let us like do some kind of contest where we each watched The Lost World and picked what we thought were the moments that Spielberg directed this part, Kep directed this part, someone's child directed this part, and let him at the end tell us who was most right, because I would win that.
He remembers
everything. That man is timeless. The man is never going to die. Oh my God, he's going to die tonight. Now that I said that, this is your fault,
Seth. I wouldn't dwell on it. But now that we've spent a substantial amount of time talking about the second movie, which we've done an episode on, we should probably talk about the third one. This masterpiece that Spielberg produced because he had absolutely no interest in showing up and doing this. And that would be Jurassic Park 3.
I was going to say it's fine that we wasted 25 minutes at the beginning of this episode because Jurassic Park 3 only has two acts in it, so we got to kind of make up for it a little bit.
Yeah, I guess there's not much to talk about. But I mean,
there's plenty to talk about.
There are a lot of pre-production issues. There's a change of director. There's, you know, just new eyes on this.
Change of director? Oh, okay. Yeah. But Joe Johnston. I thought you meant like someone not Spielberg and then Joe Johnston.
No. But Joe Johnston did want to do Lost World before Spielberg was like, nah, I'll do it. And I don't know what that would have been like, but that's an interesting thought exercise. But Joe Johnston kept lobbying, and he got this third one. So it's interesting to compare and contrast, because I feel like Joe Johnston has some similarities to Spielberg stuff, but it seems to be in a craftsman-like visual way.
Yes.
Yeah, and
this is a very pretty movie, I think. And a lot of it is, not all of it is.
Yeah, there are a couple boo-boos, but there
are some matte paintings where you're like, wow, that's a nice-looking matte painting.
Well, I mean, I like the lighting in this movie, the color palette of this movie is a very nice... It's a lot more... It looks different than the one before it, I wish I was able to properly describe what it is I liked about it. I wish I was like a professional director or something, but I can't. I just know that, like, I look at it, I'm like, that's pretty. Not all of it. Just the best parts.
I think the thing is, it feels more like what Dean Cundey's approach was on the first one, but it is not that. It is just that I think... Janusz Kaminski? Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. That his approach on the second one was very different. So
very Janusz Kaminski.
Joe, they said it like 300 times in the behind the scenes. It's painterly.
Painterly, yes. but there's more that you're seeing here, more like fill. They're shooting a lot of stuff on set, but they're trying to make it look like a big steamy jungle instead of
Northern California. All the daytime jungle interiors in this movie drive me crazy.
Yeah. I think it also undermines like the Spinosaurus stuff, because I feel like we should see less of that during the day, that it doesn't necessarily help. But there you go.
Like, if I were to ever make a Jurassic Park movie, I would have to stipulate that the entire thing take place at night, no matter how many days the people are supposedly on the island. Yeah. Oh, at night in the rain. Yeah. That's just how Jurassic Park is supposed to be.
That's when dinosaurs look good, at least when you first reveal them. You know, that's my problem with Jurassic World. Is like, I mean, it's not my only problem, but one of my many, like, is like, which again, I also go on record as being a person who enjoys Jurassic World, the first one. But one of its many flaws is that it reveals its monster flat out in the daytime, and it does what this movie does, which is like Jurassic Park and The Lost World both like take their time in building up to the big dinosaur attack. It doesn't like, and like, you know, Lost World has this whole scene where the two, like, the two, whether it's effective or not, but the two T-Rexes show up and walk around slowly around this trailer for a little bit and get the kid before they come back and attack the place. In Jurassic Park 3, that Spinosaurus just, like, every dinosaur in every post-Spielberg Jurassic movie, like, just makes its appear, announces its appearance by yanking somebody off screen and in the middle of the day and roaring a lot and yeah, there's like no confidence whatsoever in like the way that these dinosaurs show up. They show up in the middle of the day, they yank people off screen, and then they start wreaking havoc. I don't remember where I was going with that, but
well, I mean, it's hard to have them lurk, for lack of a better term, as the T-Rexes do in the nighttime scenes in the first and second movie. You know, you can't just have a head lower down or something, because it's broad daylight, so everybody would see this thing. So instead, they try to hide it with foliage and trees and more foliage and more trees. But somehow you can still hear it, even though there is no discernible silhouette that you can pick out from anywhere. It's a very interesting approach. And I think another thing that undermines it is that I find the Spinosaurus to just generally be kind of a silly looking animal. But
yeah, it looks like a monster.
Yeah. I know it's a real thing and all that, and they went through a lot of trouble to be like, what's bigger than a T-Rex, and let's be as authentic as possible, but it still looks like...
Yeah, okay. Authenticity is another thing. Like, Jurassic Park came out... I was watching Jurassic Park 3 tonight, and I was doing the thing where I act really smart in front of my kids and just relay the dino knowledge that I learned when I was his age when these movies were coming out to him, as if I'm a paleontologist. And I'm watching it, and I'm telling him, you know, after the first movie came out, it was discovered that it was determined that the T-Rex was more of a scavenger than a predator, because their bones were found near other piles of bones and things, and that mainly its arms, that if it were a predator, it would need to run very fast, and if it were to trip and fall while running fast, it would have no arms to support itself, and it would break its neck.
You ever see Meet the Robinsons?
Yeah, with the
big
arms
head
joke.
And tiny little arms.
Yeah, it's great. My son has a great shirt that's like T-Rex doing push-ups, and it's just a T-Rex like with its face against, like, face down on the ground, and its arms not reaching.
Did that shirt belong to you at one point, and then you grew out of it and gave it to him?
No, but I wear it regardless of how small it is when he's not around.
Wear it around the pool.
Yeah, I'm wearing it right now. What was I saying? Oh, like, Jurassic Park, the very first one, came out at literally, like, the most perfect opportune time in the history of scientific research, because it was before we discovered the T-Rex was a scavenger. It was before we realized, they probably all had feathers. Like, it was the perfect time for a Jurassic Park, for a dinosaur movie to come out, and all the dinosaurs to look like we all thought dinosaurs looked like. Because, like, by the time we get to here in JP3, oh, the T-Rex, he can see you when you move, when you don't move. And, oh, the T-Rex, he's a scavenger. He just eats dead animals. All the raptors, they have feathers and stuff. And it's not that it's weird, like, you know, dinosaurs don't have a right to be authentically themselves. It's just that's not the dinosaurs that you showed me in the first movie. And now we're in a universe, a cinematic universe, in which I have expectations for how animals will look.
But mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, is there something about the fact that Jurassic Park, the first one, holds up so well that we kind of don't really care how accurate they were?
Well, yeah, we don't, also, you can kind of buy into, like, they're tampering with DNA and stuff, so they just look the way they look, because they're trying to, like, fill in the blanks. But you don't necessarily expect enormous amounts of mutation to have occurred on the island that would allow stripes to emerge in the second film, and then for the quills and more stripes in this one.
And what was up with the red one with the horn?
He was judging them for reaching into the poop.
Oh, that's the Carnotaur, right? The Carnotaur or the... I don't remember which one it was, but it was the one that in the Lost World book changed colors like a chameleon.
Oh,
I remember that.
Yeah, that one was badass, and it never made an appearance anywhere else. Well, the Indominus, I guess, is a version.
I was gonna say, wasn't
that.
It also like I don't know, not see through or whatever, but it was camouflage or something.
Yeah, yeah. The you know, I think that the feathers and everything show that by the time you get to the third one, they're just grasping at everything that they know and thought worked in the first one, like authenticity and I get it, like totally get it. But like, man, you read the pre-production stories of this movie, it's just like a living nightmare for anybody who's ever tried to write or tell a story professionally.
As somebody who has not read about the pre-production woes, can you enlighten me a bit?
I was waiting so long for you guys to ask me to read you my research. So, Seth, and by research, I mean, and by research, I mean my childhood. So, I actually learned some things looking at this movie that I did not know. Like, for example, I actually did not know that the original script that was being developed for this movie, it was announced June 29th, 1998. Spielberg acting as producer. Michael Crichton was reportedly going to collaborate with Spielberg to create a storyline and write a script. The film was set for... This is 1998. So this is 2 years after Twister, which Crichton had a credited screenplay on. I have to relate everything to when Twister
Somebody
came out, so everyone
bell.
Knows. Yeah. Somebody hit a bell. The film was set for release in summer 2000. So Spielberg's original idea for this involved Dr. Grant. This is just so insane. Discovered to have been living on one of Injun's islands. He apparently would have snuck in after not being allowed to research the dinosaurs and was living in a tree like Robinson Crusoe.
He's gone that mad was, with passion for studying yeah. the dinosaurs.
He apparently went all Colonel Kurtz on everybody and was living in a tree. And but Joe Johnson, who's a smart guy, was like, why the hell would this guy ever go back to an island with dinosaurs? And so the next draft of the script, this is one I did know about, was about a group of teenagers marooned on Isla Sorna. But Johnston, let's see, Johnston rejected the draft, saying it wasn't a badly written script, it just read like a bad episode of Friends, which sounds like a badly written script.
Well, I mean, that sticks in line with everything that came after the first Jurassic Park. Everything seems like Jurassic Park fanfic written for TV.
I think I would say that's what everything after Jurassic Park 3 feels like. But we're not here to talk about Jurassic World. Especially Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
I've seen your Letterboxd. It's cool.
Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah, you follow me on Letterboxd. That's where I tell my real secrets about movies.
Oh.
Because I'm afraid that anyone that I will ever get a chance to work with will rehear this podcast or read my tweets. So the second film script had a pteranodon escaping from Isla Sorna and like killing a bunch of people on the mainland, which was going to be investigated by Alan Grant. Billy Brennan came into this draft. A bunch of military dudes, which I'm done with the military dudes in Jurassic Park. You didn't ask for my opinion. Grant, actually, you did. That's why I'm here. Grant's group crash lands on Isla Sorna while a parallel investigation is being carried out on the mainland. This is the draft that they started building sets for. Like, sets, costumes, and props and everything were being built for this script.
So it's like CSI Isla Sorna?
Yeah, it sounds like it. Five weeks before filming began, Johnson and Spielberg rejected the entire script. $18 million had already been spent on the film at that time. Johnson felt the script story was too complicated, and the simpler rescue mission plot, which was suggested by David Koepp, was used for the final film that we saw. Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor wrote, they rewrote the script they rewrote a script. They wrote a script. I don't know how much of it was actually shot, but when they shot the film, they were like, the script wasn't finished while they were shooting. They shot pages that eventually, he says, we shot pages that eventually went into the final script, but we didn't have a document. It just all sounds like a nightmare. They shot in Hawaii. They came back. They shot a whole bunch. Then they thought of an ending. They flew back to Hawaii, shot the quote unquote ending. the act two to three break, as you called it. John August is somewhere in the mix here. And apparently he did a good enough job to be invited back for Minority Report. Cause he did some ghostwriting on Minority Report as well. Yeah, so I was unaware of the Robinson Crusoe draft. That's the one I really want to read.
Was it ever actually like fleshed out to a draft, or was
well,
it
it's
just
gonna
like
be Joe?
An
it's
idea.
Going to be by me. No, I don't know.
That's a good
I
time to talk about talk our about sponsor Story Clock. No, I wouldn't mind seeing the beats of that story. I do agree that it is out of character for Dr. Grant to want to do that thing. It's not out of character for maybe somebody who wants to sneak in there and go study everything and try not to die, but yeah, not necessarily him.
Yeah, and you know, it's like, yeah. Okay, let's break the story here. If there was some, like, is there a more interesting story of someone going into an, I was just thinking in my head, like, of someone going to the island who does care. And maybe there's someone close to Alan Grant, but then that's just basically Indiana Jones 4.
Well, I was going to say the only person that I would think after the first two movies would be John Hammond, and he would just want to observe everything because that was kind of his thing, right, at the end of number two. He just wants to be the naturalist and let them flourish in their own environment. So, I mean, presuming that he was alive and, you know, mobile, he could hang
crazy,
out in a tree and watch
crazy
everyone.
Ass John, like the rescue mission to save crazy ass John Hammond living in a tree. That is such a bizarre movie that I would pay so much money to see.
And then
see
you get
it.
There and he doesn't want to leave. He wants to hang out with his creations. And then you can go like all Island of Dr. Moreau or something where he's like making his own new dinosaurs.
He's making his own? What, just like with like beakers and stuff? Like
actually,
in the tree?
You know what it would be? It would be like genetic culling of the herd. He would see something that had evolved that didn't match the evolution of the way dinosaurs evolved back in the prehistoric days, and he would go kill those dinosaurs and only let the ones flourish that he deemed original or something. I don't know.
I think you have strayed
I think
a little
you're,
bit.
I think
from...
you're in the metaphorical tree now on the island.
It's fine. It works.
Yeah. Well, there is some stuff about this film that I feel could have worked better with more time, because my understanding is they were also under the gun because of the contracts that had been signed for people's availability, so they had to shoot starting on a certain date or they were going to lose people, and they had also spent like what $18 million or something in pre-production up to this point, so they were kind of stuck with things that they had already built for the other draft. It's kind of a little Aliens 3. But that they so they had to like rework this into a story, so I can see why we got this story. I just wish they had had the time to make the characters work, because I think that's really the part that I dislike, because it's fine when they're like running from one awful thing to the next awful thing. Like, I don't care. Like, they do a good job shooting stuff happening. But anytime they're just standing there walking and talking, it's awful.
It is.
And it really doesn't read like things that people would say. It doesn't seem inspired in any
and
way.
It's a bunch of really great actors having to say really dumb stuff. And that's like, that's a really real heartbreaking thing about it. It's like, you have William H. Macy and Tay Leone, and I like the guy who plays Billy. What is his name? He was on, he was in something recently.
Alessandro Nivola.
Yeah. I don't know. I like him. It's a bunch of good actors.
Mm-hmm. He was,
And Michael Jeter, character.
Oh, God. He was Nicolas Cage's brother in Face. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, Alessandro Nivola. Yeah, he was.
My world has just been upended.
Well, now we just need the sequel to Face Off about Alessandra Nivola's character.
On Isla Sorna. Would...
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Switching faces with a dinosaur.
Switching faces with a raptor egg. I'm going to smuggle this egg off now.
Jeez, wait, he switches faces with the egg? So he's just a man with an egg mm-hmm. face? I like your mm-hmm. like... Oh, man.
I don't really think these things through. I'm not a movie writer like all these professionals are. But yeah, I think it's just all this character stuff. You just throw all these people into the mix and, like, you have these writers writing stuff so that they have things to shoot that day. And you're not really going to get, like, a character arc out of that or any development, really. And they try to fake it a little bit by being like, oh, we're divorced, but now we are going to get back together because William H. Macy lost 25 pounds and Tay Leone's love interest died at
he's
the beginning of the film.
He's also a very safe driver,
so...
Joe. Don't forget that. He's a very safe driver.
yes.
But yeah, it's a lot of that character injection stuff that drives me crazy. That's like that you get when you're like, well, we need this to feel real, so let's have them talk about mundane things so that they're real humans and real people in an elevated circumstance. And it just ends up being mundane conversation that we have to watch.
Oh, hey, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to walk in on you changing. And wife that I used to...
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this is a very short movie, too. Do you think it's just they realized that they were just like walking towards the beach for an hour and a half and then like putting obstacles in their own way? Or did they like try to have something else happen and then they're like, oh, this is stupid, let's just cut this out, and they ended up with this very simple kind of too simple kind of anemic story at the end of it? Or was this just like, yeah, we don't really know what to do, so we're just gonna have them like go that way and then there'll be some obstacles and then I guess they'll get there or something?
I think they had specific set pieces they built sets for and they built creatures for. They had a pteranodon cage. They had, you're going to have raptors at some point. But I'm trying to think, the big set piece of the pteranodon cage, the plane crash didn't...
The boat sequence.
That's what it is. The boat sequence and the... I would argue it's the boat sequence and then the... There was a more extensive version of the raptors... In the, like they were going to sleep overnight in the lab and the raptors would break in or sneak in. And that was actually more drawn out and suspenseful. But
Raptor
sleepover.
they can all paint each other's nails, the giant claws.
but they're all striped, paints. I think they just had certain big set pieces and they had to check them all off. And then somebody was like, hey, let's make Ellie's husband a military guy and just have him show up on... That's such a bizarre ending.
Yeah. So while mm-hmm. they were struggling with having pages and not a complete script throughout the shooting process, you don't think at any point they actually were like, you know, halfway or two-thirds of the way through shooting and they finally cracked it and they're like, oh, got it, we just need to go shoot these couple more pieces and then we'll have a thing? You think they just like, well, we've got, you know, 90 pages in the can, so that's a wrap?
I think no, they did, like they got it and they were like, we still need an ending. What if you showed up on the beach and the military showed up? Okay, cool, let's go out to Hawaii and shoot that real quick. And that was the tail end of
it's like
production,
you know, 60 seconds worth of material. They come out of the trees and there's a guy in a suit and then a bunch of stuff drives up on the beach. Like, that's it.
But that they couldn't, I mean, that's before you could go shoot that in Atlanta on a stage and then build the whole thing digitally. Like, that still was not a common practice.
Well, I guess you got your helicopter mm-hmm. and your flying
tanks. The money was spent. You have all the tanks. Wait, how do the tanks get on the beach? Now that I'm thinking about that.
They're
There were amphibious vehicles.
Oh, that's right.
We didn't really see the boat they came off of. We saw some battleships. I don't know, some stock footage or something later.
Yeah, that's what I usually do when 5 to 6 people might be missing. I send 2 battleships and storm the beaches.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
I make one
rapid
phone
escalation
call
from the end of Lost World, where they were, you know, they had the massive military escort of the unmanned ship taking the T-Rex and the baby back. But apparently in this movie, William H. Macy said the U.S. Embassy said, sorry, LOL, your kid's dead. But now all of a sudden, now that people are on the island, they're very concerned again.
Also, she may have just had a prank call. Like, she barely talks to Alan, and he's drowning.
Listen, I've gotten a lot of calls from people screaming the river at me. And I always take it seriously.
You always call the Coast Guard and the military.
I always call the Coast Guard.
You always go, we have to send the military to Isla Sorna because that is definitely where someone would shout the river.
Yes. What else does the river mean, Joe? It means I'm on a dinosaur island. Send the Coast Guard.
You go sit down at your laptop. You punch up Find My iPhone. You punch in your friend's username. And you try to remember their password. And you get it wrong a couple of times. So you got to wait 5 or 10 minutes for it to reset.
Okay, guys, I have a special guest who wants to say hi, who I think just finished watching Jurassic Park 3. Am I right? Even though he's already watched it. But say hi.
Sup.
And there was my son making his first appearance on a live podcast. Good night, buddy. Love you. My wife texted me from the other room saying that Elliot, my son, had just said, hang on, I don't have my glasses on. He said, you know, this is a really nice island. Besides all the dinosaurs, it's really green, which I thought was a terrific observation.
You should take that boy to Hawaii post haste.
Oh, yeah. I should.
And then you can show him all of the filming locations, and he'll be incredibly bored and just want to go hang out by the beach.
He would. You know, I've shot something there. Got to go shoot it all. I've probably talked about it before, but like specifically planned an entire shoot on Kauai where we could go to all the locations, like the location of the sign and where the T-Rex paddock and the raptor cage were, and I have all kinds of cheesy pictures of me there. And
did you act surprised like you came around the corner and you're like, whoa, look at this, you know what this reminds me of, I bet this might be.
Well, have you ever been like the where the sign is, you're driving up, you're like, I hear this is where it is, where, what are the, like probably right past these 2 nondescript posts, and you're like, wait a minute, these 2 posts are where the giant sign and gate were, and then you watch the movie and you're like, they planted a lot of extra plants. That's all. That's the story.
Yeah. I did a helicopter tour of Kauai, and we flew over the waterfall. Apparently it's a very dangerous and long hike to get to that waterfall, so it's recommended for aerial viewing only. But
you heard that they built that helicopter landing pad like 3 times over the course of a production, because it kept washing away. They built it once and it washed away. They built it again, it washed away, and they finally built it and they shot it and then it washed away.
Well, nature finds a way. But enough about lush tropical islands. Let's talk about something else that's in the end of this film that I think was supposed to be an arc of some sort, and that is our journey from the 3D printer to talking to raptors and telling them, please take eggs, but don't kill us. And that's your scary raptor arc.
Well, if you can call for help in their language, it's like saying parlay to a pirate, like they have to go find the head raptor to come negotiate your surrender with them, and that's when they ran off, but then they just ran the other direction really fast.
I feel like I would love to do a version where you put subtitles underneath it, and he's just basically like, I am seatbelt. No, listen to like, paint.
Tomato. Leaf. Yeah. Stick.
Exactly.
Like, what is this guy's crazy? What is he talking about? Like, we should probably leave him alone. He probably fell on his head or something.
We should not eat him. He probably has diseases. Yeah.
And this is, I think, one of the things about the trajectory of the Jurassic Park movies is that they defang the raptors every time you see them, because they know they're so popular that they want to have them on screen more.
Oh, yeah.
So you can't have them constantly killing people. So instead, they kind of are sort of befuddled, like they are in the second movie, where for some reason they can't kill anyone that's a main cast member, but they are taking people down in the high grass. And then in this one, they can't kill anybody again, because they're just sort of like, I will be within 3 feet of you, and then I will take a couple swings, maybe claw at your backpack, and we'll call it a day. It's very weird, but we'll circle you and make some noises at you, because we are trying to communicate in our language to you as slowly as possible for your human ears, and then you will know that that means give us eggs.
But at least, I mean, the new one, they jump on people and just wrestle them around. Like, they don't eat people, they don't cut into them, they're just like, they're just throwing them around, like tickling them. And, yeah.
They're dogs.
And, or they're yanking them out of frame. I can't tell you how sick I am and bored I am with people being yanked out of frame. Have I said that enough? Because that's all, yeah. Yeah.
You hear that, Hollywood? Quit yanking Seth around.
Yanking people out of my frame.
Unless it's by a twister that pulls him out of a window.
Is that a reference?
Yeah, twister can pull people out of frame because it's, you know, it's wind and stuff.
It's wind.
Dinosaurs that grab people by the head with their hand claws are probably not great.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing about the raptors with the silly 3D printed voice box thing in this movie that I guess is a little beneficial is that that's one thing that I guess is like dinosaur related. I think one of the criticisms I had about Lost World was that most of the stuff involving dinosaurs could have just been like, I don't know, rhinos or elephants or something in Africa or something. In this movie, it does actually make use of the fact that they're dinosaurs slightly.
By
sort of.
By blowing into a whistle at them?
Well, the idea that, you know, they're smart and they can talk and stuff.
Yeah, we got a Snapple fact out of it, Dan, but it doesn't really like absolve them of not having a satisfying ending or any plausible danger for the characters,
right, of course,
from these raptors.
It's playing to the actual animal rather than just being like, put a lasso around that thing. It's a dinosaur also.
I'd never thought about that. You're right. The second one is kind of like a safari adventure where they've just replaced all the animals with dinosaurs.
It's a bummer because, you know, dinosaurs supposed to be, you know, spectacular and terrifying. And well, I guess in this movie, they're terrified of stuff. Like, that's the other thing in the Lost World. Like, nobody seems appropriately scared. But in this one, the people who aren't scared are the dumb ones who get eaten pretty quickly.
No one seems appropriately scared in the second one. Dude, like, Julianne Moore is making that scared face the entire movie.
You mean when she's, like, running after the dinosaurs because she wants to pet them and take very close pictures of them, but then her camera malfunctions?
That's stegos.
Them?
Stegos are herbivores. My son is walking into the room again, and he thinks he has the nerdiest dad in the world. I'm sitting here yelling into a mic, they're stegos, guys.
Should be a breakfast cereal, stegos.
Well, it's because I already made the Lego my stego joke earlier.
Yeah. That's why I'm thinking breakfast. But yeah. So in this one, let's also talk about, I guess, another dinosaur set piece that we have, and that is the pterodons, and the aviary stuff. While I have a lot of criticisms about this movie, I do think that they did an okay-ish job with that for the most part, excluding the parachuting.
Nope, you're wrong. Parachuting's really awesome. Parachuting is super awesome. It's illogical completely, but it looks awesome.
Yes. Well, that's what I mean. Like, Billy is suddenly an expert base jumper that knows how to very delicately maneuver to exactly this teeny tiny little stump of rock where the kid is and get him out of there.
You pull the right one to go right and the left one to go left. Like, that's not so hard.
Well, yeah. But, and,
yeah, no, it's so easy when you talk about that.
But the thing is, like, you know, like, it's like playing Fortnite and you're like, oh, I found this amazing plunger bomb. I'm probably never going to get to use it, but I'm going to hang on to it and use up an entire block of my inventory so I can have the satisfaction of throwing it at someone if I live to do that. And it's a big risk because that you could put a better gun there. Billy, it's his entire backpack is that parachute. Like, he's walking around with just a parachute on his back, no supplies, and he's like, I don't need supplies anymore. I've got a camera bag with some eggs in it, but this parachute's going to come in handy here on land. I'm going to need it.
Well, it's a good thing he can kick through vending machine glass so easily and grab some snacks whenever he needs them.
Who can't do that?
Yeah.
William
H. Macy.
At least the cage in this movie is metal instead of glass, so that's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
They did have a line that Grant says, let's take this with us. Maybe we can use it to signal somebody when we get to the beach. So there's the very faintest of reasons why they have that.
Hey, Joe's defending the parachute.
Very faintest of reasons. But anyway, I like the fog. Yeah. I like the pterodons, like, wobbling out of the fog. And I really love the creepy shot when they're going after Billy, and then we rack from the one
I'm
looking
so
at Billy who turns around over
shot.
His shoulder.
So let me tell a story that no one asked me to tell. When I was I'm at the premiere for Star Trek Into Darkness, and I'm sitting in the not the Kodak Theater, what's it called? Dolby Theater. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And
I think so. The one on the Paramount
lot? The one in Hollywood. Like down across from the El Capitan. The one that's like the theater, the Oscars theater.
The premiere premiere. Okay.
So I'm at the, sorry. Sorry.
I forgot that Seth was that fancy.
I'm so sorry. I should have mentioned.
That was like a cruise.
I should have mentioned. No.
Something.
I was at the premiere sitting down on the floor. I did it because for backstory, I did that insurance commercial and I did it with Bad Robot. And so I got invited to the premiere, which was probably the coolest thing I've gotten to do in my career so far. So I'm sitting, because of stories like this, I'm sitting in the theater and my wife is like, who is he? Who is that guy back there? He looks familiar, which is all we did the entire of the premiere. But I looked back and I'm like, that's Quentin Tarantino just sitting back there, just devouring popcorn, just inhaling popcorn. He is shoving popcorn into his face. The movie's not started yet. The red carpet's playing up on the screen. And Quentin Tarantino is just becoming one with this popcorn. And it just like in this movie in Jurassic Park 3, when the Iraq focused to that pteranodon in the foreground that you was there the whole time, but you didn't realize it. Except in my case, replace the pteranodon with Leonard Nimoy. There's your title. Literally was like a turn and looked me in the eye. And it was like, I did the rack focus in my head and was like, oh no, I am very close to Leonard Nimoy. And he just looked at me. And I immediately thought of that shot in Jurassic Park 3. That's what I think of now whenever I see that shot.
You think of Leonard Nimoy going,
I think,
well, yeah. Why are you just staring at
exactly.
He's shoveling popcorn in his face, but whatever.
Exactly. Oh man.
Yeah.
It's a good start. Well, I mean, that's
nice.
A very nice start. When I see that shot, I just think, like, you know, somebody overhears you like talking trash about them a little too loudly behind their back and they just turn and stare at you.
Mm-hmm. That's this movie right now.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that to us. I love that.
Joe Johnston is
that
staring
whole scene
at
was, I agree. It was really, really great. And if you watch, you know, Stan Winston, well, he's dead, but the Winston with his company now is called Legacy Studios.
Stan Winston
School. Yeah, Stan Winston
School.
So
is the name
like
of it?
His actual shop.
Probably not accredited, but I
have. Yeah, well, it might as well should be because like it may as well should be his shop is now I think called Legacy Studios, but yeah, Stan Winston School, is on YouTube, and they have a bunch of free, really great in-depth videos of all this old archival, like, you know, VHS behind the scenes footage that they shot of like their various stages of builds for all these dinosaurs. And the Pteranodon, they built this Pteranodon suit for the walking. Oh, and the Pteranodon is like walking in, like, in the cage, and you see it in like two shots in the final movie. And it's a shame because, like, if you watch, go online and you find these tests, they're awesome. This thing is like terrifyingly cool, and that it's one guy with this giant extended limbs and wings and a giant like head thing, and he can like walk around, and it's, God, it's the coolest thing ever. And it's in like one shot. I think Grant kicks it.
Supposedly, it didn't work as well on the set when they were shooting.
Well, that's so most things that are built.
That's why
now
they went digital, like, with it.
Which,
according to Joe Johnston,
yeah, that's most things now. Like, in everything, like all behind the scene, all like current CineFX issues are that have anything in them with like physical costumes or creatures being built, it's always, we ended up not using so much of it, but it was great reference to have on set. And like, you see that in The Hobbit, you see that in, you know, I have a friend who just finished producing a movie, I just realized I shouldn't talk about it, but a friend who produced a movie that they had a physical creature built, and it apparently just does not hold up. Because, and honestly, this movie, I was just thinking, when you look at all the conversations of like practical dinosaurs are so much better than digital dinosaurs. Look at the Spinosaurus in like the first scene of this movie. And I understand it's not totally fair because it's in the day and it's on a set. But like, the T-Rex was at night in the rain, but it was also on a set. And the T-Rex looked great. So yes, like, there's a way to shoot these things, but I mean, look at that Spinosaurus. Look at the CG shots of the Spinosaurus in this movie, and look at the mechanical ones. The CG ones are far superior.
Whoa, I was going to go
were?
The other way.
Really?
No, see, here's the thing. I think they went a little crunchy with how they shaded it, so when they would intercut from the mechanical one to the CG one and back again, you'd get something that felt like a completely different dinosaur that moved differently from the puppet. I guess if they had just been consistent with doing one or the other, being consistent with doing the CG one entirely, then it probably wouldn't have been as jarring, but it is pretty strange.
I felt like the puppet to me moves like a puppet. And, like, I buy the CG one way quicker than I do the puppet.
Yeah, it moves. It seems like they wanted it to have it move fast, but it just moves fast in a really linear way and sort of stops, which makes it feel more like construction equipment.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
To me, but it just in terms of the surface quality of it, I prefer the surface quality of what they had with the puppet than what they were achieving with the CG one, especially in those daytime ones. And in the T-Rex fight, it really sticks out as strange
to
me.
The whole thing is strange.
They're like, we got to do bigger, badder dinosaur, so we better show you, the audience, how much danger these characters are in by immediately killing the T-Rex. That'll show you how much more dangerous this is than a T-Rex. Also, he's going to eat a satellite phone, and he's going to ring every time you see him the rest of the movie, like the crocodile in Peter Pan. But
you weren't terrified
anyway.
By the ring sound? You didn't like the way that foreshadowed things?
Here's the thing. I kind of liked the phone.
It's not bad. I don't think it's anywhere near as suspenseful as like what they did in the Pteranodon cage, like with the coming out of the fog and stuff. It's just like,
it's not. And it's a one time only gag. It's a one time only gag of like, oh, it's my dad's phone. And if you thought that he had the phone, it would be great. But you're confused about the whereabouts of the phone. So when they're like, oh, the phone, let's go get it, you're instead like, wait, who has the phone? Who had the phone? I don't remember him having the phone. And then the dinosaur has it.
And it's another one of those shots, just like the rack focused Pteranodon, where the camera spins around 180, and it's just standing there going, "Hey guys."
Well, that's one where it's like, was he? Why was he waiting? Why was he waiting for them to see him before it's like, I'm here, and then chases after them? Like,
dramatic
he was letting
effect.
The call go to voicemail before he decided to actually didn't accidentally answer and have to talk to somebody.
So stupid.
He's like, uh-oh, maybe they heard me. I was being so sneaky.
I, the giant dinosaur, was being so discreet, and the cellular device within me gave me away. I'm
not sure how that works in an audio perspective, like with insulating material, absorbing sound waves.
Yeah, well, but also...
And
it's a dinosaur. A giant dinosaur. Like, I've had issues with the Jurassic... Like, this is my issue with the Jurassic Park movies as a whole. My one universal issue is that they...
Well, good. It's a universal movie.
I knew you'd go there. I set it up for you, Joe, and you knocked it down. The fact that sound can be so like dinosaurs can choose when they're going to be loud in their like just presence and when they're going to not be. Like the T-Rex is so big that it shakes glasses of water and creates booming noises when it's far away and showing up, and it also walks really slowly. But when it's first coming up, but then when it runs really fast, it makes us in. Like, and sometimes it can hide in the woods and leap out at Gallimimus. And this, you know.
Well, the only thing shaking the ground and making water ripples in this movie is the opening credits.
Oh, man. Yeah. That with the, like, the Final Cut ripple transition that plays over the logos.
So crazy.
And when it says, my favorite is the Isla Sorna, so-and-so miles off the coast of, North Carolina, of Costa Rica. Restricted! Like, how, like,
giant red text.
Yeah. Got it. Like, I got it. Thanks for the exposition titles.
Yeah. It is... I agree with you. And you even had that in the first film when... they're trying to run away from the raptors in the lobby.
Oh, and it just shows up in the lobby.
And the T-Rex. Yeah, he snuck in through the like open doorway thing on the side because of the construction. But he's so loud and noisy and casts shadows that it is impossible for him to have done that.
At least they might have been distracted by the fact that the raptors were about to eat them as opposed to just like, I'm here now.
Well,
yeah,
that's true.
I mean, it's a little, you know, T.S. Rex Machina, but...
Wow. Have you made that joke yet on the podcast? I haven't listened.
No.
Oh, my God. That was... I'm sorry. I just want to take a moment and take that joke in. T.S. Rex Machina. Okay, I'm done. I got it. I'm good. Keep going.
Okay.
Nope, hang on. I'm sorry. Hang on a second. I need more time. I need more time. Okay, I'm good now. Go ahead.
Yeah, so for the Spinosaurus, they tried to have it both ways. It's, like, bigger than a T-Rex and more threatening and all this stuff.
And also quieter.
It keeps chase... super quiet. They apparently have, like, rubber dampeners on his feet or something. I have no idea. But super quiet and also incredibly focused on just killing these teeny tiny little bozos on this island. In a way that makes it also seem less threatening because it feels like less of a force of nature and just sort of like, oh no, we've hit another part in this theme park ride where the Spinosaurus is going to leap out now. And that's kind of what it is. It's just sort of like there and it pops up and then it goes away. And that's your Spinosaurus interaction. It gives up pretty easy too when they get into their little metal hut on the top of the cliff before they go to the aviary. It's like you're an enormous thing that literally broke through the restraining fence that was designed to hold dinosaurs in. But then you're like, oh no, a door.
Well, it's nothing like earlier in the movie. Earlier in the movie, it was like, oh no, trees.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't understand the Spinosaurus, I mean, at all.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems with all these movies. The dinosaurs don't act like animals. They act like monsters with a personal vendetta against whichever particular character happens to be in a scene.
Now, when you say these movies, you mean...
Yeah, and they tried to explain that away in the second film with the baby abduction.
I'm sorry. When you say they act like monsters, not animals, you mean The Lost World and On, right? You don't mean in Jurassic.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Jurassic yeah, 1, totally. They act like actual yeah. animals.
And that's what's so great about them, is right. that they totally act like... Yeah, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, so in the second one, they try to make this very focused thing on, you know, babies and stuff. And in this one, they kind of tried to do the same thing with the raptors, but there is no motivation for the Spinosaurus to be chasing these people. It just sort of doesn't like them or something. Because it goes through a lot of effort. Like, I don't know how it went down to the bottom of the aviary thing and all that stuff and to chase them along the boat.
And
stuff,
where was it throughout whatever. The Lost World? They went all over that island in the Lost World. And if it's everywhere they go in JP3, why was it not everywhere they go? Now, why was it not at least one place in the Lost World? Besides the fact that they hadn't written it yet, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's just sequelitis is the only explanation for the Spinosaur, because it's just Spinosaur. Like, we need bigger, badder thing that we haven't seen before. They don't want to work with the stuff that they have, because part of it, they want to just put on spectacle rather than just relying on the situation or characters, to make dinosaurs we've already seen interesting, which I feel like is a shortcoming, of the film, because when you're relying on that as a crutch, then we can just pick apart these new dinosaurs that are there for seemingly no other reason.
Well, I mean, these movies are like, oh God, there's a really good metaphor that I can't think of, an analogy that I can't think of, but like, they do better with time. Like, you have, the more time you give in between them, the better, like, the more you have to work with, and the more they can be effective. But regardless of your thoughts on Jurassic World itself, like, the Indominus Rex is a more effective, dinosaur, big bad dinosaur, than the Spinosaurus is. And the overall, like, setup, like, the overall setting for Jurassic World, not the story and the characters itself, but just the whole concept of the first one is essentially, which is a park full of dinosaurs, but this time people are there. Like, you get one chance at that every 20 years to do that movie, and then you got to wait 20 years until you do it again, and it's a callback and it's a nostalgia thing. But after that, you just have people going back to islands and bigger, badder dinosaurs that are really just the same as the last bigger, badder dinosaur. I mean, the trick, I think, is just waiting 20 years in between movies, and then you can, yeah, then you can do a bigger, badder dinosaur, and people will like it and won't care.
Mm.
Well, you got 20 years to work on your script.
If I don't have it by now, I'm not going to have it in 20 years.
No, we cracked it. Hammond's going to be living in the trees. It's going to be great.
Oh, we cracked it. I was going to pitch one time, where the it was more of a joke, and then I entertained it for 2 weeks, and now it's back to being a joke, but where they returned to Isla, so this is pre-Jurassic World, they returned to Isla Nublar, and the dinosaurs were all missing, and I was joking, like, you just had no dinosaurs for the first half of the movie, and maybe in the first, like, two acts of the movie, and then the third act, suddenly, oh, wait, there they are, and then everyone gets attacked by dinosaurs. I never turned it into a story of any kind.
Were they living underground or something?
No, someone had taken them and transported them, but then that ended up being Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and that was a big pile of... one big pile of shit.
Dan and I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it is... That is one big pile of shit. I had
as
to,
anticipated.
Sorry.
I mean, yeah,
well,
I mean,
not really a
listen,
shocking surprise.
I have respect for everyone who worked on the movie, and I honestly don't mean, by this, I mean, literally, Juan Antonio Bayona is a great director, and I don't have any beef with Trevorrow and Derek Connolly. I don't. because I would not have wanted the task of making that first Jurassic World. But this one is just like, it is a first draft of a script, and it is like, it's like, talk about it on a podcast bad. Yeah.
Well, you've come
which
to
is
the
what
right
we
place.
Should do. Came to the right place.
I don't hope that we continue to get the reputation for people who just crap all over things all the time, but I think it is worth trying to discuss why these things don't work. And you know, there are so many fundamental flaws in a lot of these things. Like the entire concept of Jurassic World, just like, we tamed it. We've got all these giant things and they're in cages now. It's like, well, if you watch the first one, you kind of see that, like, you don't have control, you can't have control, and that's, like, the idea that you got kids riding around on little mini triceratops or whatever it was in that scene, it's like, no, I don't think that, I think your initial premise is just bad, and you're just rolling with it, and you need to stop.
Yeah, it's like why I won't mount a TV to the wall, because gravity.
Same thing.
It's just, you know, somebody in some writer's room goes, all right, in Jurassic Park 1, they couldn't tame the dinosaurs with the cages, but what if they could? It's like, well, you can't because they're dinosaurs and we're humans and we're stupid because we don't know. It's like, well, what if we learned how their entire ecosystem actually works when we were newbies in Jurassic Park? It's like, well, it's been 20 years. How much are you actually going to learn about their ecosystem in 20 years? You're still just doing the same. Anyway.
And then he said, but aha, yeah, and well, that's the story. It doesn't work.
That's right.
They get out.
Uh-huh. Here's $200 million. Well, Go make it.
Have you heard the joke, see the tweet where it was like, Trevorrow pitching, is like, all right, so here's the story. There's a volcano on Dino Island. They're like, amazing. Then what happens? Like, I'm going to need millions of dollars before you find out the rest. They're like, all right, here it is. And he goes, and they go, what happens next? He's like, no idea.
It explodes? I don't know. I mean,
yeah. Oh,
is there a bigger Chekhov's gun than a friggin' volcano? Like, oh, by the way.
You know, it does. Speaking of Chekhov's gun, that does bring up something, a little bone to pick about something that didn't pay off in this film. When Grant comes across the kid who's been living by himself for 8 weeks and is very unfazed by it.
T-Rex pee.
There is the reveal that he has a beaker full of T-Rex urine. And he says, you know, it's great if you... need to get all the other animals to go away, but it does attract one very large animal. And so I'm like, okay, great. They're going to totally use this on the Spinosaurus. And one of the other T-Rexes are going to come over and do something. Nope. Doesn't go anywhere with that. We just have a beaker full of T-Rex urine for no reason.
And that...
He could have at least said, like, this is only for use when you're in trouble.
Okay. Look, I was with you up till then, Joe. Now, I was going to say, you just summed up the movie really well. We have a giant beaker of T-Rex urine for no reason.
More like P-Rex.
All right, I'm back. I'm back on board.
Anyway.
All of the funny, quippy lines right before the cut go to Udesky, so you got to wait till Udesky's back in the shot before you can do that.
Mm-hmm. He's a booking agent.
Mm-hmm. With a big rifle.
And he's dead. Mm-hmm. P-Rex Machina. I'm just thinking in my head, combining two favorites.
P-Rex Machina.
There's so many layers that we can work with now. We really have a lot to do that would save the Jurassic Park franchise with comedy. I feel like, or something masquerading.
I mean, what did this movie do to the franchise? It kind of just went like, yeah, there's a lot of sort of story you can tell, but really it's all kind of rehashing and it's not terribly interesting. So I guess this well's not dry, but we haven't figured out how to use it properly. So I guess this trademark goes back up on a shelf for a while.
That is an excellent description, because that's what it feels like. Like, and it feels like it again now. It's like, this well isn't dry, but we haven't figured out how to use it. Like, 100%. And it's easy to assume, oh, it's run dry. Dinosaurs. But
if you had to make a guess, what would the next Jurassic Park movie be? Because I have a guess of what I think it'll be.
I know what it will be because it sets it up in Fallen Kingdom.
Oh, God.
Sorry.
Does it set it up well enough
that
it's actually going to happen?
It sets it up to where it is... Oh, yeah, well, it's actually going to happen for sure because it's making boatloads of money. But it is...
I'm so mad at everyone, yeah, including
listen,
you, Seth.
Listen, the third one, can I tell you, the third one, the way it ends, you'll laugh when you see the last shot and you'll understand what I mean here. But it works without that context. The third one, if it is not basically La La Land with a Velociraptor, I'm out. I'm out of my fandom for Jurassic Park because that is all it needs to be. It needs to be about Blue, like, learning how to, like, have a roommate and, like, going to auditions.
Does Blue save Jazz?
Look, I'm not saying that Blue does. I don't know. But Blue can. Blue is in the position at the end of Fallen Kingdom to save Jazz, to fall in love with Ryan Gosling, and to, you know, like...
To be
find
true
its
to himself,
place
really. To
in
be
this
true
world.
To himself in a city of opportunity.
Yeah, herself, totally.
Oh, Blue's a girl.
I all the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are female.
Is that so?
Yeah,
you control their chromosomes. Mm-hmm. It's real easy.
Again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just gonna start saying lines from the movie, like just literally reading the script.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I want to know what your guess was, Dan, of like what the next one's going to be.
My guess is they go all RoboCop and they retcon everything after Jurassic Park 1.
Oh, yeah. Halloween's doing that now, too. Have you seen?
Oh, sure. I'm not a big horror person.
Yeah.
I'm not. Well, I mean, there are certain ones that transcend the genre, and that would be Halloween. But Joseph Gordon-Green, I think, is the... David Gordon-Green.
Yeah, that's the new trend now. You erase everything after the first one, and then you just update it for you know, modern audiences.
Who else did that? Superman Returns did that, didn't they?
Terminator.
Oh, that's right.
Terminator's doing that?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's a bummer.
Yeah, the RoboCop one they just announced with what's-his-face, Neil Blomkamp.
Oh, yeah, Neil Blomkamp.
He's doing that, too. We're going back to... something based on a RoboCop 2 treatment that was unused from the 80s, but written by, coincidentally, the same guy who wrote the new Terminator that Tim Miller
is doing. Weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So get out there, Seth. Get in your pitch meetings and pitch them a Jurassic Park that retcons everything after the first one, and I bet somebody will pick it up.
No, I will not. You know why?
We demand it.
I'm gonna read you. I'm gonna just straight up read you my Letterboxd review of Jurassic World. I'm not gonna read it. I'm just gonna tell you. I felt watching Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom. I felt like I was reminded of Steven Spielberg and Lucas who were hanging out on the beach in their weird vacation they would take together. after it's not weird. It's just okay. Like. Go for it, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. Take your Hawaiian vacations together and build sandcastles and talk about movies. Actually, now that I'm more I'm describing it, the more fun it sounds, and I wish I could go on these trips.
I was going to say, what other directors are you going on vacation with?
Ryan Connolly. Ryan Connolly are 100% taking beach vacations the second we get a chance.
I was going to guess that, but I didn't want to say it out loud. I'm glad you confirmed it, though.
Oh, you can always assume that if there's any kind of like mildly romantic situation that I will be in with another filmmaker, it'll be Ryan Connolly. So,
good to know.
I forgot what I was going to say.
You were
going to
say why you won't retcon everything.
Yeah.
Fallen Kingdom, etc.
Because Spielberg wanted to make a Bond movie and Cubby Broccoli wouldn't let him. And so he... And so Lucas, I was like, well, I got another thing, like a new version of James Bond that's better, that's newer and more Indiana Jones-ier, because that's what it is. And Indiana Jones came out of that. Like, I understand that the way the business works now, it's very hard to get an original thing and have it be as big as the pre-established thing. But like,
well, also,
man,
dinosaurs, kind of hard to do that outside of the Jurassic franchise, probably, but...
Challenge accepted.
Life finds a
way. Oh, damn it. That's the better
movies
response.
Find a way. Cinematic find universes a find a way.
Brilliant.
All right. Any final thoughts on Jurassic Park 3?
No, I think that we don't need to have an ending. It's Jurassic Park 3. Let's just cut this podcast off.
We're all just on a beach and One lone guy who I guess was dropped off by a helicopter
yeah,
will be
there,
and there? Then the amphibious vehicles come on.
Man in a suit. It's a very bad idea. It's a good theme for the movie.
They send him in first to make sure things are okay, and then they send in the military.
That's how the SWAT teams work. Like, the first guy through the door is always a guy in a suit who doesn't have a weapon.
With an intercom.
It's like, we know they don't like business people from InGen, so we're going to put a guy down in a suit just to see if the area is clear.
They're like, is this the right island, or did we go to the wrong one?
It's the cartographer.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
It's apt that you're doing it much quicker than the actual song, because in this movie, they're just like, yeah, play it real fast, and then we'll get on with it. It's fine. You happy? Fine. There we go. Roll credits.
Oh yeah, it is. It's you with that like military march thing. Bum bum ba da bum bum ba da bum ba da bum bum. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Jurassic Park 3. I don't have a song for you this time, Dan. I'm sorry. I don't have a song for Dan Sturm. I only have Jurassic Park 3 obscure facts.